Hey, if music came naturally, we'd all be doing it. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we're talking with cognitive psychologist Gary Marcus, author of Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. The last time Gary was on the show, he told us about learning to play music as an adult after a traumatic childhood encounter with a recorder and this song, Mary Had a Little Lamb. We barely touched on the idea, though, of what exactly makes us musical. We know that humans have certain inarguable instincts for flight or fight, building communities, reproduction. But what about music? In a moment, we'll ask for more of your calls and comments, but let's begin with Gary Marcus, who joins me once again in our studio. Hey, Gary.
Thanks for having me back.
So is music an instinct?
Well, I think a lot of people think that, and you might get some nasty calls, but I don't think so. I think that music is actually something that we learn. I think it's a cultural technology. I like to make an analogy with an iPhone. An iPhone is something that anybody can pick up easily. We all love. We really are attracted to it. But I think of Steve Jobs as a kind of genius reverse engineering the mind, saying, what would appeal to people? And I think you have generations of musicians that have learned more and more ways to hold listeners' attention, to make them feel good or to make them feel sad. And when we think about music now, we're thinking of the product of a lot of engineering. Mm-hmm. So something like Western harmony that we all take for granted has only been around for 1,000 years. So the music we hear now is in some ways more compelling. That doesn't make it better, but it means there are more and more techniques to lure people in.
But at some point, somewhere back in the dawn of human history, somebody started singing or banging rocks together in a rhythmic way. I mean, where did that come from? If it's not an instinct, if it's not a survival mechanism, what is music?
Well, I think that it appeals to us for lots of reasons. One is aesthetic. So if you know how to make the music, you can move people, even if it's not necessarily built in. The same way a filmmaker can move people, even if film is not directly built in. So one thing that I talk about a lot that I think is really interesting is the way that music gives us two different rewards at the same time. So the brain really likes, and we talked about this once before, the brain really likes when we hear something familiar. Mm-hmm. So if you hear a steady drum beat, you're like, yeah, I get that. I'm into that. You kind of get a little bit of reward for comfort and feeling like you're doing things right. You also, ironically, get a reward for the opposite, for novelty. So if you hear something that's totally new, you're like, hey, I've never heard that before. That's really cool. And what's great about music, what makes music so compelling, or one of the things that makes music so compelling, is you can get those both packaged at the same time, and in fact packaged in different ways at the same time over the course of a song. So you start with a steady drum beat, and when that gets boring, you put in a fill, right? Everybody mm-hmm. does that. So you have this anticipation, and then you have this little bit of novelty. Or you stick with the same rhythm throughout, but you keep changing the melody, or you keep changing the harmony, or you keep changing the lyrics. So there are many different ways of simultaneously getting both rewards, maybe even a lot of both rewards.
And when you say rewards, you specifically mean?
Dopamine in the brain. That's what reward is all about. You mm-hmm. get a hit of dopamine for something, for making a correct prediction, and you also get a hit of dopamine for the unexpected and feel like you're learning something.
All right, so if it's not an instinct, it's still affecting our brain. I mean, there's still
Absolutely.
Something within us that's happening. Is it in our genes?
Well, I think it is indirectly but not directly, which is true of most things that we do. So there might be a few things that are directly in our genes, like the Krebs cycle regulates how metabolism works in individual cells. That's pretty much spelled out directly in our genes. But a lot of the things a lot of the things that we do, there is an indirect kind of specification in the genes. The genes build your brain, but they don't build your actual activities in a given moment. And what you do in a given moment is a combination of all the brain wiring you've ever had, which is coming both from genes and experience, and also like what's happening in your mind at this particular moment. So mm-hmm. you can't dissect and say 50% of this conversation we're having is genetic and 50% of it is environmental. A lot of genes that went into building the kinds of brains that could learn language and talk about abstract ideas. And then there's a lot of learning that we do so that we can place these ideas in context. And it's the same thing with music. There's mm-hmm. there's some prior built-in things, and there's a lot of stuff you learn from your culture.
We're speaking with Gary Marcus, cognitive psychologist and author of the book, among other books, Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. And you make the point that, you know, Tiger Woods, you know, was not born with an instinct to play golf.
That's right.
But he certainly has some kind of genetic predisposition to be a great golfer.
Exactly. So it's not that the genes said, and you will go forth and golf, but the genes said, you know, this person is going to be an ambitious person, an athletic person. They're going to develop muscle relatively quickly. They're going to be coordinated. And the genes underwrite all of that. You still have to practice. So you get some set of talents. They're not specific to golf or specific to music, but you get a set of talents about coordination, about industry and you know, rehearsal and being willing to do things, or you don't. I mean, some people aren't born with that desire to practice and they don't get as good. So the genes and things like practice actually interact even at that like most basic level of do you practice at all? And then the genes, you know, can give you a better ear or can give you better muscle and so forth.
So just as athletic talent can be passed from a Bobby Bonds to a Barry Bonds in the world of sports, we've seen musical talent passed from parents to children quite often. Ravi Shankar, the great Indian sitarist, kind of an interesting case study here because he's got two daughters, Nora Jones, the great jazz pop singer.
Who's a great musician, but entirely different form of music.
Right. And his daughter, Anushka Shankar, who studied with him, grew up with him, learned from him. So the nurture has been completely different experiences for the two daughters, but the nature, the genes seem to be in both of them.
That's right. I mean, strictly speaking, you only share half the genes with your sibling and half the genes with your parents. But clearly, they both daughters got a lot of genes from Ravi that prepared them to know about rhythm, to prepare them to naturally acquire rhythm, probably to be compassionate. So empathy is another part of being a good musician, being able to feel like how you're going to be able to move other people. They probably both got that in spades. So there were lots of genes that allowed them to be musicians. And then, that's right, the nurture took them in very different places. They studied different genres of music and developed their own voice.
But that musical gene, it may not be an instinct, Gary Marcus says, but it certainly can be genetic. Here's the father, Ravi Shankar. And then Raga Gangeshwari is the kind of thing that sitarist Ravi Shankar became world famous for, but his daughter, Nora Jones, growing up in a different part of the world, has made a very different sort of music. This is the brand new single from her forthcoming record, Little Broken Hearts. From Nora Jones, first single to be released from her forthcoming album, Little Broken Hearts, which is due at the beginning of May. And we're speaking with Gary Marcus, author of Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. He's also director of the NYU Center for Language and Music. Was with us recently on Soundcheck to talk about his own journey into becoming musical in the middle of life. You know, you were nearing 40. You decided to pick up the guitar, although you'd had some pretty...
That's right. I was not born into Ravi's family, unfortunately. I love my family, but I was not blessed with any of that musical talent.
So, when I asked you at the beginning, is music an instinct? I mean, your almost instinctive answer would have been no, because for you,
Well, clearly it wasn't an instinct for me. I worry about that because as a scientist, I've come to the conclusion that music is not an instinct, but it's obviously the case that I was on one end of the scale, the zero end of the scale, hence the title Guitar Zero. And some people are born with more talent, but I still think that the talent they're born with isn't specifically about music. It's a talent about learning, about being sensitive to pitch, about being sensitive to other people's feelings and so forth. So it's a set of talents that allows them to acquire music. The one talent that I was born with that's relevant is a talent for practicing, for self-discipline. So despite not having good ears at all or a good sense of rhythm, I was able to develop at least some of that such that I can go out and play people and not totally embarrass myself now.
Which leads to my final question for this portion of the show, because we have other topics we want to cover. If music is not an instinct, and there are people at the guitar hero end of the spectrum, and then
me,
some of us at the guitar zero end of the spectrum, why does music seem to appeal kind of naturally and almost as if instinctively to all of us?
It's not quite universal. So it's interesting that people like Freud just were left completely cold by music. But the familiarity and novelty that I talked about, there's the fact that once you know a few songs, you can relate them to other things. And so the way that our memories work, our emotional systems work. So it's almost like music is a perfect storm for the human brain. It's not literally built – the brain is not literally built for music, but it just – it fits really naturally. So can an MTV video. So, I mean, there are lots of things that can really appeal to the brain. But music is something that naturally fits with all of these things we're prepared to enjoy.
Gary Marcus is with us, and in a couple of moments, we want you to stay with us because we're going to get into what sets musicians' brains apart from the brains that the rest of us have. Gary Marcus is staying with us, and this is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with cognitive psychologist and author Gary Marcus. His most recent book is called Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. We were talking about whether human beings have an instinct for music, and if not, why does music come easy to some and not to others? What do we know, Gary, about the brain of a musician as opposed to the brain of a non-musician?
Well, anytime you learn something, your brain gets rewired. That's just how we learn things. So if you learn something, it doesn't change your heart or your liver. It changes your brain. Music is special because it changes so many parts of your brain. Maybe because music isn't built in. It actually draws on a whole wide array of different brain regions. So if you're playing an instrument, then you're going to rewire your somatosensory cortex so that you have a better feeling for your fingers as you press the keys or the frets or whatever you're playing. You're going to rewire your prefrontal cortex as you plan a piece. You're going to rewire Broca's area as you do the sequencing of the individual actions that are part of music.
So can you, I mean, looking at fMRIs and other, you know, brain imaging things, can you sort of tell the difference between a musician's brain and a non-musician's brain?
You can. I mean, you can more easily, to be honest, tell the difference between, say, a sample of 10 musicians' brains and 10 mm-hmm. non-musicians. If you look at any one individual brain and just do one scan of it, you're not really going to be able to tell so much. But if you look at a whole set of musicians versus non-musicians, you'll see something different. And in fact, if you look at a whole set of guitarists, they might be a little bit different from a whole set of pianists.
Well, now that's what was going to be my follow-up question. Would it be a big distinction between, say, a singer's brain, where that fine, you know, motor coordination with the fingers is not so essential, but where language, ability to process and interpret language comes into play?
I would certainly expect that. I'm not sure the right study has been done, but I would certainly expect that. There is a lot of muscle control, it should be pointed out, in singers, controlling the vocal cords.
Sure.
So there's a lot of coordination there, too. But the language being involved is going to make a big difference. Although sometimes you see, like, a keyboard player actually singing their part, like a jazz keyboard player singing while they're doing it. That actually seems to be important to their process.
Mm-hmm. Now, last time you were here, we talked about your own sort of journey at learning mm-hmm. the guitar as someone who, you know, didn't really have much of a music sensibility internalized. You know, you said you had a really terrible sense of rhythm, et cetera. One of the benefits, of course, is that you can now play the guitar.
Which is fabulous, I have to say.
But another benefit is you have rewired your brain at a time when we've been told that our brains are done. You know, they're formed, and that's what you got, and that's why you can't learn a language, and that's why you can't really teach an old dog new tricks.
That's right. And there's this cliche that says you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but it doesn't actually turn out to be true. You probably can't teach them quite as quickly as you can teach the younger dogs, but there are great animal studies now that show that you can teach the same member of the same species the same things as a younger one if you just take more time. So I talk in Guitar Zero about a great study with owls where you stick a prism on the eyes of an owl, and that distorts the visual world by 23 degrees. And the trick is to match up what you see with what you hear. And young owls can do this, like, very quickly. You put a 23-degree distortion, they have no problem getting it. Older owls can't do it if you just smack the 23-degree prism on their eyes. But if you put a 3-degree prism one day and give them a week with that, and then a 6-degree prism, 9-degree, eventually the old owls will be able to do the same thing as the younger owls. We now know that there are some adults that are able to learn languages natively as adults. So it's just not as cut and dried as that cliche, you can't teach old dogs new tricks. If they're as persistent as the young ones, they can do pretty well.
So your own experience picking up the guitar, the study with the owls, et cetera, it all suggests that it's not necessarily what you're learning. It's that you are learning. Is that right?
Well, one of the most important things is how you practice. There's this idea going around, you need 10,000 hours of practice.
Right.
And first of all, it depends what you're learning. So some things, you know, tic-tac-toe you can learn in a weekend. And, you know, guitar is really a lifetime pursuit. So different things take different times. And then it really matters, first of all, whether you have talent, which we just talked about. And it also matters how you practice. So if you just keep practicing the same riffs over and over again, you're going to get good at those riffs, but you're not going to develop a broader understanding of music. You're not really going to be able to write your own music in the same way. So how you practice, especially if you can target your weaknesses and say, I got this part down, but this other part I'm not so good at. For me, that was rhythm. Then you can become a better learner.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a whole science to be developed of how to learn most efficiently.
And again, while you're learning that, while you are sort of attacking your own weak points, your brain is rewiring itself. It's maintaining that plasticity, they call it.
That's right. In fact, if you play the same riffs over and over again, you're just looking at changing a few neurons that are already pretty efficient, making them more efficient. You're not spreading that change throughout the brain. So that's one of the reasons you do want to target your weaknesses, is because you want to spread out the improvements to different kinds of processes.
So what if my goal is not to learn to play? Can I get that same effect, that same kind of plasticity in my rapidly aging brain by listening differently, by listening to a different kind of music?
I think you can get some of that. I think that you learn a lot by listening. Adults know a lot more about music than kids just passively having listened to a lot of music. And if you listen to different kinds of rhythms, you can pick up, you know, different kinds of music and so forth. So I think you can learn a lot by listening. I think playing is ultimately probably a better way of learning because you get more engaged. And I think that's probably the key reason. If you were a really disciplined listener, you did things like actually count the measures, for example, which most people are too lazy to do. But if you really get to that level, I think you can probably learn a lot by listening. In fact, some people practice away from their instruments. I talk about this briefly in Guitar Zero. One person who's a teacher in New York tells her students to practice their pieces without their instruments while they're on their subway. And that's partly a listening exercise. It's partly an attention exercise. So one of the challenging things for a player, but maybe for a listener too, is to keep on track.
Mm.
And if you play on the subway in your head, you realize, oh, this is where I space out. Well, that's where you need to practice. Don't start the song from the beginning every time, which is what a beginner does. Say, this is the place where there's a transition and I lose it because it's too repetitive here or whatever.
So we're talking about things that can keep your brain active, the sense of they call it plasticity, you know, the ability of the brain to rewire itself well into, you know, past the point of youth and adolescence and stuff. So, you know, I didn't grow up in Indonesia, but I did eventually fall under the spell of Indonesian music. But I guess what you're saying is, for me to get the full effect, I should actually like sit down with a pair of mallets and one of these metal percussion instruments and learn how to play this stuff.
I think you're going to learn more that way, definitely.
Example of Indonesian gamelan music and a group called, or style called, Gamelan Gong Kebyar. And Gary Marcus here with me in the studio.
You could also learn a lot about particular kinds of music by not just by playing it, so you could pick up the mallets, but by dancing to it. So people can Google, there's a lot of gamelan dancing happening right now. That's another great way to learn about those rhythms.
So getting the body involved.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just your, you know, what's between your ears, that's important for the brain as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a late convert to that, having only recently learned to dance in time. And so those rhythms are out of my personal league, but I think a lot of people could learn a lot by dancing to them.
Well, now, you bring that up. Mike from Queens leaves a question, and Mike seems to come from your self-described end of the guitar zero end of the music
spectrum.
It's not
as lonely as, you know, you might think. There are
so Mike wants to know why some people can't keep a beat. Is it something in their brains, ears, what?
It may actually be in your vestibular system, which guides balance. I think in my own case, the only way to really know is a postmortem, and I'm not up for that. It limits to my scientific curiosity. But short of the postmortem, I'm going to guess that in my own case, it was about the vestibular system. So, which is about balance, and it's part of the ear.
Okay.
The vestibular system, I think, was responsible for why I could never stand to be on a swing or a roller coaster. I would get nauseous in the back of a car, still do sometimes. And I suspect that I have a hyperactive vestibular system, an overreactive one. And it turns out there's some good recent data that suggests that the vestibular system is tied to rhythm. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of movement and so forth. And if you're getting, you know, topsy-turvy just from the movement, that's not going to help you to develop a sense of rhythm.
Soundcheck listeners, have you picked up a new skill, you know, post-adolescence, or attempted to learn something new? What was your experience like? Or if you have a question for Gary Marcus, you can leave your comment or question on our website, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, or the website, wnyc.org/soundcheck. So the idea of, you know, listening differently as you get older. One of the reasons I brought that up was, you know, there's this phenomenon that we've seen over generations where people come to things like Western classical music later in life. You know, if you haven't grown up with it, something's got to be happening up there in the brain when you start listening to this much more sophisticated and complex type of music.
Well, a lot of that tradition is really great music, but we're not trained in schools anymore to understand what's going on. So when I talked before about that novelty and familiarity, that's all relative to what you know. So whether something seems novel to you or whether it seems familiar and comprehensible depends on what kind of training you've had. So,
well, that Indonesian stuff, that's in a very strict rhythm, you know, and it's sort of clomping along at a beat that you can pretty quickly latch onto. But the sounds and the tuning
is all different, and so you don't quite know how to make sense of it the first few times that you hear it.
Right.
So over time, you can learn more about classical music, even if you didn't learn as a kid. Sorry, there are great books out there about, and now great podcasts and so forth, to help you understand the elements. If you don't understand the harmonies and so forth, at first it seems elusive, kind of like John Cage's random music. Like, if you don't know what the elements are. Same thing with Schoenberg, right? He's got these tone rules. They're actually systematic, but it's very hard for the ear to grasp them. Those, even with training. A lot of classical music, you know, lots of people can pick it up if they have the training, and then the Schoenberg sort of pushes what the human ear and brain is even capable of.
Schoenberg sort of casts music adrift from tonality entirely, using all 12 notes. You know,
exactly. So every 12 notes, you know, you get the same set of 12 notes, and we're used to having a scale. So in a sequence of 12 notes, some subset of 7 is going to repeat, and that's going to give you a sense of, like, home base and center. And if you don't have that, you feel a little bit lost. So a lot of academic musicians love Schoenberg and what he has led to in terms of opening up new territories, but very few non-academic musicians really can just sit there and appreciate it.
Speaking with Gary Marcus, his latest book is called Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. And as we've learned, you can teach an old dog new tricks. May take a little longer. And many people still, as they approach middle age, you know, finding their way to classical music, as an example. Up next, as we continue, we'll take your questions and comments. The music instinct, music as nature and nurture, as something that is kind of a feel-good process in the brain and good for the brain as well. We'll talk about all of that, your calls, your comments, as we continue with Soundcheck. ¶¶
Doe, a deer, a female deer. Ray, a drop of golden sun. Me, a name I call myself. Far, a long, long way to run. So, a needle pulling thread.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Cognitive psychologist Gary Marcus, who's also director of the NYU Center for Language and Music, is with me in the studio. We've been discussing whether musicians are born or made, and whether they can be made at any time in life. And there are some questions and comments. You can call us at 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC, or leave your comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And here's a comment from Gary, from Jim, who writes, "Is the ability to compose music distinct from the ability to appreciate it? I can enjoy a song and even play it on the guitar, but I'd give my right arm to be able to write one."
I think composition is a much more sophisticated skill, and it goes back to the fact that it's easier for us to recognize something than it is to produce it. So you can tell, for example, when something's in time, but it's more of a skill to be able to create it in time. And you can tell when things are in harmony, but it's more of a skill to be able to figure out how I'm going to make those elements. So composition is an amazing skill, and I have enormous admiration for anybody that can do that in any genre. Maybe the most sophisticated in some ways might be the classical compositions, mm-hmm. Where there are lots of underlying themes and so forth. But there are lots of rock pieces that I still just sit there and I'm like, how did they think of that? And I think that's the right reaction, is to be amazed that people were able to do that. One thing we do forget is how much craft goes into it. So, like recently, I listened to Glenn Frey of the Eagles talk about those songs, and they seem so transparent and seamless that you don't realize how much craft goes into it, how many times there are revisions, and they're like, let's change this little piece. So a lot of great songs, there is a fair amount of work, but then you sit there and you see that the Beatles compose, you know, half of Sgt. Pepper like in a week or two or mm-hmm. whatever it is, and it's just sort of amazing. Even when you take into account all the practice and all the other songs they've made, it's still amazing to be able to put all those pieces together.
So talent is definitely, even if music is not instinctive, it can be genetic, and talent is certainly something that you're either born with. I mean, can you acquire talent?
I think you can develop skill in particular things. So, or you can buy it. So the Beatles bought George Martin, right? And so George right. Martin helped with some of the pieces that they themselves mm-hmm. didn't know how to do.
All right.
So, you know, part of talent is actually finding the other people that can help you to do the job. And so you certainly develop skills, but having that natural sense, for example, of empathy, of how to move a listener, that's probably something that Paul was born with.
All right, let's take some calls. Mark is with us from Parlin, New Jersey. Mark, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi there. I have actually a couple of comments. First of all, I am a third-generation musician, have a doctorate in music, and worked in computers the last 20 years. One of the observations I've had from teaching and performing is that there are two different skill sets, if you will. There are the creationists, or the people who play by ear, and the recreationists who work from the printed music, and that those skill sets are very different. That's the first area. What do you think of that?
I do agree they're different skills. I think conservatories tend to emphasize the recreation, not in a slavish, literal way, but still within narrow parameters, whereas there are other traditions where you're making it up completely every night. And I sometimes feel sad for people that went to conservatory and don't feel like they can improvise, because for me, the greatest joy in music is improvisation. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily make up something that's new to the species or the musical tradition, but when I sit there and I pick up my guitar and I make something that's new to me, that's a great joy. And I feel like some musical traditions don't emphasize that as much as they maybe should. Of course, there are lots of cultures where that's all there is, and the recreation thing is actually the thing that's a historical anomaly.
Mark, you had another point to make.
I did. There are those who constantly pull up the thought that music and math are parallel, and that's why musicians make good technical people or whatever. My own perspective is that it comes from a personality quality that if you're able to sit in the practice room and beat yourself up fixing your own mistakes for 5 or 6 hours at a time, that you can probably sit down and program and solve your own mistakes.
Mm. I tend to agree with you. I think the data on the correlation is relatively weak. So we know that people that are bright and have a lot of persistence get good at math and they get good at music, but we don't know the the exact causal relation. I think one thing you learn from music is just what you just said. It's a kind of persistence, or the Yiddish word is zitzfleisch. You learn that if you just sit there on your bottom, eventually you're going to get it. And that's an incredibly valuable skill. You might be able to learn it in other ways, but once you have it, that allows you to get good at anything. Once you realize, I can start at something that just seems mystifying and eventually get to the point where I kind of own this, I think that's an amazing feeling. I think one of the reasons why I would put more money into music education is just that, this sense of power you get of, if I work at something, I can do it, as opposed to, I work for this for an hour and I pass the exam. That's not getting the same sense of developing new skills. And we live in an economy where, you know, everybody has to learn a new job. It's really important for kids to feel like they can own a new skill.
All right, let's head into the control room. Joel Meyer's been scanning your comments and questions on the webpage. Joel.
John, Cliff from Manhattan has some tough love for us. Cliff writes, people definitely have different skill sets. Not all people make good doctors or carpenters or musicians. It's just the way it is. People who don't naturally have a given skill set have to work a lot harder at it, and often for a smaller reward. It's good to know yourself and when you should or shouldn't pursue a given field. So Cliff from Manhattan recommending limits. Now, Sue from Greenpoint has a really interesting question. She writes, is the ability to read sheet music at all related to musical talent? As a teenage flautist, I had a scary ability to play almost any piece by ear after a couple of tries, but my inability to sight read a novel piece and play it on command got me kicked out of the school band. Any hope of vindication?
Well, I mean, I would start with the fact that there are lots of great musicians that don't read at all. So there are all many genres. In fact, most genres of music aren't written at all. Then you have lots of blind musicians. Then you have people like Paul McCartney that couldn't read but still made great music. So I think
the late conductor Eduardo Mata, who for many years led the Dallas Symphony, did not read music. He was a conductor.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does go back to exactly what you said, which is there are separable skills. If I could go back to the previous question just briefly, I absolutely agree. Some people are cut out to be musicians and some people are cut out to be other things. The amazing thing I found out in my journey, I didn't disprove the notion that there's talent. I think I reinforced the notion. My speed of learning is slower than Pat Metheny or Jimi Hendrix. But what I did learn, and this was really new to me, was that you could really enjoy something that you're not that good at. So if you're talking about, I want to be a professional musician, then, you know, someone like me shouldn't even try. But if you're talking about, can you find incredible pleasure in something that you're not good at? Well, it turns out the answer is yes.
Michael has a question. He's been listening in from Brooklyn. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, I've been playing guitar for about 45 years, and I learned how to play guitar before I ever really learned how to read music. I don't read very well, but should I even bother at this stage?
Well, kind of a variation on the old dog, new tricks thing.
I mean, it is always good to learn new things, and although I said that I don't think sheet music is absolutely necessary for being a musician, it's a wonderful tool. So you can learn a lot of new music from different traditions once you can use sheet music. Of course, nowadays, you can also use YouTube. If you can play by ear, then you might get away without that. But one of the reasons why sheet music is so valuable is as a means of communicating different kinds of things.
And I guess the final question I want to ask you, Gary, is one that I'm not going to expect an answer in 1 minute or less, but the question of which came first, music or language. First of all, are the two parts of the same stream, or are they separate and parallel?
I think of them like a Venn diagram, overlapping circles. I think the language part of that circle that they share is older, but there's lots of things that are special to music too. So music cares about the center of a tonal pitch spectrum, what we call tonality, and language doesn't. So there are lots of things they share, like sequencing, and there's some evidence that developmentally in the lifetime of an organism, language comes just a little bit earlier. So if you give a child a choice between speech and instrumental music, they actually prefer the speech. What they'd really prefer is to get both and to have somebody singing.
Right. Is that why scientists, neuroscientists, and cognitive psychologists such as yourself tell us that vocal music affects the brain differently from instrumental music?
Well, you've got a whole extra tool, you know. So I think vocal music can be much more powerful because you've got all that lyrical association. It's sort of the way that poetry can be more effective than prose. And the linguist and musician Ray Jackendoff describes poetry as being a combination of language and music. And I think he's right about that.
Yeah. Gary Marcus is a cognitive psychologist, director of NYU's Center for Language and Music, and author, most recently, of the book Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. Gary, nice speaking with you again.
Always fun to talk with you.
This is Soundcheck.
You can see.